Welcome everybody, this is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. It was a delight this week to meet John Lydon. Now John is Blizek Professor of Religion and Film at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and he has been editor of the Journal of Religion and Film since 2011. Now it's a field that I work in as well, and John talks about how he is keen to get people to take it seriously. We discuss the importance of interdisciplinarity and how his religion and film work was born out of his teaching and his hobbies. Now, John was born in Seattle and grew up in Connecticut in the 1960s. We learn that he was raised a Lutheran, wanted to be a scientist at the time of the Apollo program, and ended up doing a theology degree due to his own religious questions. Now, he has always loved movies, and his earliest memories include seeing The Music Man in the early 60s. John reflects on how he appreciates pop music from the past more now than he did at the time. And we learn that he comes from a musical family. His father was an accountant and had a naval career during the Second World War. He was at Normandy, and his mother was a high school maths teacher. He talks about how culturally he feels he grew up in their era and discusses the extent to which he is shaped by his family. We talk about the change of sensibilities over the decades, for example, over same-sex relationships, and we touch on the Trump presidency. We talk about how people with college degrees tend to vote differently to those outside the academy. And John identifies the important role in getting students to discern sources. And we talk about the danger that comes when you only look for sources that support what you think. We learn about John's online Star Wars course, which sounds fantastic, and how there shouldn't be a distinction between education and something that is fun to do. Then towards the end of the interview, we learn that John's memories tend to be positive. He talks about the illusion of asking people to adjudicate on their own lives. His mantra, to paraphrase Tony Stark in Iron Man, is that everything works out the way it's supposed to. We discuss the dangers of only remembering the good times and reflect on this in the light of lockdown. And John explains that he's disappointed people are not pulling together now in the way they did during the war. What an immense pleasure via Zoom in Nebraska to catch up with John Lydon for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. So it is an absolute pleasure to have John Lydon from Nebraska on the line. It's great to see you again. And I am literally seeing you, John, even though, of course, we're many, many hours and many, many miles apart.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here, Chris. And I'm enjoying Zoom technology in many ways. It allows us to do things like this across continents. So that is one of the pleasures of the pandemic.
Well, it is really, because I was just, and before we started recording, we were talking about how our teaching has changed beyond recognition and doing these interviews, because I get to interview my heroes. I get to interview all sorts of figures who I used to think, well, next time they're in the UK, or if I should find myself, say, in the US, you know, these are my go-to people. But in a funny way, against the backdrop of this horrible pandemic, it's kind of brought us closer together at the same time that we are socially distancing. So there's lots of paradoxes afoot, but we are going to have a great opportunity to reflect on your life and career. Do you want to say a bit, John, about where you're based and what it is that you do?
Well, currently, I've just started a new position as a professor of religious studies and the Blizek Professor of Religion and Film. So it's a named religion and film professorship at University of Nebraska, Omaha. So this position was just created, and I applied to it this year. So in the middle of the pandemic, have moved back to Omaha in that capacity. Up until last spring, I was at Grandview University in Des Moines, Iowa, where I was the liberal arts core director. So I was a faculty position as well, but I had more administrative duties, essentially as sort of the head of the general education program. So that was where I went after Dana College went out of business, where I was for almost 20 years, which was also here in Nebraska. And when that school went out of business in 2010, I took the job at Grandview, which fun fact for your listeners that they might not know is Dana College and Grandview College were the two colleges founded by Danish Lutheran immigrants in the United States. So when Dana went out of business, there was a sisterly affection from Grandview to help out some of us, and I went there. But I was not in the religious studies department there for most of my time there, because in the liberal arts department, overseeing interdisciplinary courses, which I enjoyed a lot. But I am happy to be back in a religious studies department, and specifically with teaching religion and film, which is, of course, my love, my great interest, and able to focus on that. And I've known people in this department at UNO for many years. And as I think you know, I've edited the Journal of Religion and Film, which comes out of UNO, since 2011. That journal has been around since 1997, I think, and I've been somewhat affiliated with it through much of its time. But this is the first time I've been a full-time faculty member at University of Nebraska, Omaha. So I'm thrilled to be there. Again, it's this sort of pluses and minuses of the world we live in. I'm enjoying this position. And yet, as you say, I have to teach via distance. I haven't really seen students in person. And it's a strange time during this pandemic. But I'm really, really glad to be in this position now.
Absolutely. And indeed, actually, what you just said there is right, because I was finding this very week teaching students wearing masks. And I thought, just like get to know them online, you suddenly realize that when you see them in the flesh, you're like, oh, actually, I'm not sure I actually do know you. Who are you again? And you sort of realize that getting to know somebody in person and online, it's a different skill. It's a different sort of people set. And I think this whole year, 2020, has been that sort of year of pressing the reset button and reskilling in how we use technology. And I'm sure that teaching will never be the same again. Once the pandemic is through, we'll have said, but we've managed to do all these things, and it takes out all the commuting costs, but the price that you pay is that you don't see the students. But you are right. Religion and film and the journal is exactly how we know each other. And actually, it was when I was doing my PhD in the late 90s that the Journal of Religion and Film came out. And that was a huge boon to me in those days. And of course, it was a few years later with your Film as Religion book that which I use with my students, that obviously we've got to know each other really well. So it's actually really great that all these years on, both of us in that sense are still working in the very same field.
Yeah, it's really been a delight to meet people like yourself who came over to American Academy of Religions, I think, in those years. And I met people also like Clive Marsh. So I really became much more aware of British scholars working in the area of religion and popular culture, which I think is a real interest of a lot of people in the UK. And so had more of these international connections in that way. It's nice that you all, would cross the Atlantic for that. But then, of course, I started, crossing the Atlantic a bit more, too, and coming over to England with some of these connections. So, it's, again, one of these great things about being in a field like that connects people in really disparate places who share these interests. So, yeah, I'm not sure I can recall when I first met you. It was probably in America, though, at an AAR.
San Diego, 2007.
Oh, okay. Good enough. Yeah. And then a few years after that, I came over to the UK because we had the conference in Salisbury, which was so delightful, I think, in 2011.
Yeah, no. And it's wonderful that we have this opportunity through a network that is really quite small, in the sense that the number of, I think you actually made the joke in 2007 in San Diego, that if by some horrible quirk that the building we were in were to be wiped out by a meteor, the entire, apart from I think Clive, who was not there, would actually the entire religion or theology and film scholars in the whole world would actually all disappear in one fell swoop. And I wasn't sure. It's like with students, when you often say we're a small department, we're an intimate department, we all know each other. We don't want to be a big department when it's very anonymous. But on that occasion, I thought, oh gosh, there's a lot riding on this because we're all gathered together, and there aren't many of us, and we need to keep this wonderful enterprise alive.
Yeah. Yeah, and it creates this intimacy internationally with people you've never even met, corresponded with, and maybe you meet them at a conference and say, oh, I've read your book. And, we've all read everything that the other person has read. And, it's a small field in that way, that there's a lot of people that aren't even aware of the existence of a field of religion and film studies or religion and popular culture. Although I think it's growing and it's receiving more recognition. And even the fact that this position was created at UNO in this year that I now hold is kind of a remarkable thing, because I think, a few years ago, that would not have been the case. And still, it's very hard to get, you know, a PhD in religion and film. You know, I have students sometimes will email me from wherever and who are aware of my work and say, oh, I want to get a PhD in this. Where can I go? And I think, well, you know, there are places where you can go and maybe focus on this, you know, in their dissertation work. But there's nothing, as far as I know, called a PhD in religion and film anywhere at this point. And partly because, you know, departments haven't totally recognized that. More traditional departments, you know, we have historical theology and biblical studies and, you know, and then the named religions. But this is sometimes interpreted as kind of lightweight, or, you know, people don't take it that seriously, or oh, anyone can do that. That's just fun stuff. And so we've had this effort, you know, those of us to do this work for years, to try to get people to take this study seriously and recognize its value pedagogically and from the point of view of understanding society and religion better. And I think it's getting easier to make that case as more people say that I don't feel like I'm going uphill quite as much anymore in telling people that it's a valid field of study.
No, and it was quite fun when I was doing the PhD, because it felt that making that case was part of the journey. It's like some of the myths that we talk about in our work, but it was almost as though trying to make this a field that people would take seriously. And some people would have no problem with it. And a lot of people were always very excited when I would start talking about what I was doing with Scorsese or film noir, Redemption, and so on. But the key thing, as you know, is interdisciplinarity, which is a different thing, and making that connection with scholars in other disciplines. And I think in many respects that's happened. But I certainly think 20 years ago, as you've indicated, it was a bit harder. But that also made you all the more keen and eager to make people feel that this was worth pursuing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, departments sometimes, again, even at major universities, or maybe especially there, can be very old-fashioned about these lines between departments and being an expert in a certain thing. It's a field that's been around for hundreds of thousands of years. And so something new is automatically suspect. And yet, as you say, interdisciplinarity is kind of, you know, the watchword now, increasingly, that people are seeing the value of that from a scholarly perspective in terms of understanding things better. You have a different perspective when you come from one field into another, because I don't have a background in film studies at all. I'm, you know, basically self-taught in that area. And so I, you know, started doing this work and was a bit embarrassed about that. Like, am I going to be taken seriously, or do I actually know anything about this? And yet having a perspective of being trained in theology gives you a certain point of view that you might not have if your degree is in film studies. So, and the thing is, students like this, you know, students like these kind of unique courses, and sure, they're entertaining to talk about movies, but it also allows students to see things differently, makes these connections. There's all this pedagogical value to this. And I think that's why, you know, I was led to this, because, you know, unlike some of you who maybe did some popular culture work, you know, on your thesis, you know, for your dissertation. I wrote my PhD thesis on Immanuel Kant and Karl Barth and epistemology. And that seems like a long ways from religion and film, although I can make a case how it all connects in some interesting ways. But, you know, I was very much a historical or systematic theologian looking at the doctrine of God and the influence of philosophy on theology. But when I started teaching, especially when I started teaching at Dana College, which was a very small college in Nebraska with about 600 students, I was a part of a department of two in religion. And so between the two of us, we had to teach pretty much everything. And I was fortunate, I think, in that my PhD at University of Chicago Divinity School prepared me to teach a broad range of things, because there's certifying exams there, which every PhD student had to take. So we had to know something about world religions and something about, you know, sociological and anthropological study of your religion. And so all these different approaches. And suddenly I had to teach everything to students. I was teaching philosophy and ethics and religion and society. And so it wasn't just theology at all. And then I kind of brought film into the mix and found students really liked that. And so it really came out of my teaching and trying to find a way to make things interesting to students. And also, I loved movies so much myself. I always loved movies, but I never considered it an academic interest. It was just a hobby. And then suddenly I thought, well, I've seen a lot of movies. I know a lot about movies informally. Maybe I can utilize this in some academic ways.
Yeah, and it's funny when that happens. My story is very similar to that because it was in the early 90s. I was a student, an undergraduate. We never looked at popular culture. And I was doing, I think it was when I was doing my master's on death and immortality. And I was watching The Witches of Eastwick one evening. And I thought, oh, this is a representation of the devil. And maybe I'd been working on Augustine in Hell, I think, earlier that day. And I thought, there's obviously a crossover. But I knew that there was no way I could bring that film into the academic study because that just wasn't what we did. And that was fine. But then time went on and I was thinking of possibly doing a PhD. And I just thought, I'm sitting on a gold mine because I thought, well, it's for me to show that rather than recycle something I've done before or, you know, do something in within, you know, if you're going to, you have to, it's the same, I guess, with what I'm doing in the nostalgia interviews, asking that question, what is it that makes you get up in the morning and feel excited? And I thought, well, that this is exciting me. I've got a background in theology and then an emerging interest in film. I didn't really go to the cinema before I went to university. And then it sort of...
Oh, really? Wow.
Fascinating, because I was always a radio person. And then and now I put out these film reviews and obviously not, you know, not professionally, but it's just interesting how that what became a sort of going along with friends to the cinema in the school, in the university holidays, then became something that I did on my own and then did obsession, you know, obsessively. And then to have that part of my research, I don't know anymore where the line can be drawn between things. It sounds similar to you, actually.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I think I did more of it also, you know, starting with the teaching, but then I, you know, going to conferences, I was interested in learning more about what other people were saying or doing and hearing some talks. And again, there wasn't very much going on at the time. There weren't a lot of good books. And that's part of the reason why I wrote Film as Religion, is I wanted to have a decent book that I like to use in my classes, because I couldn't find something that I really liked. And I would hear these papers too, sometimes given, and thought, well, these people don't know any more about movies than I do. You know, they're trained in religious studies, and I think I've seen more movies than they have. So even though I didn't have the academic credentials in that. And again, it's, you know, ironic from a publisher point of view, because publishers have responded very well to this kind of work. And again, it's because it's unique and people like it and it can be used in classes. So, you know, I've always had, you know, great success in getting things published. Whereas when I finished my dissertation, I couldn't get it, you know, published to save my soul. You know, no one was interested in it. It was just, you know, kind of abstruse theology. And, you know, I thought it was a decent dissertation, but honestly, it just didn't have the same interest. And so as soon as I went over to popular culture stuff, it was much easier to get published, ironically, even though, as you say, sometimes tenure and promotion committees don't smile on this sort of work if they don't take it as seriously. Luckily, I didn't really have that problem being at a school where, you know, teaching was really the central thing. And, you know, also I think they could see the benefit of some of this insofar as it connected to my teaching and teaching in an interdisciplinary way. So, and then once I was tenured, I felt I can do whatever I want now. I can write, I can publish anything I want and no one's going to stop me. Although then, you know, as it happened, I had to seek tenure once again, when I changed institutions, but didn't know that was going to happen at the time.
Yeah. But how did the journey then all start for you? So in terms of where you were born, how your life started out, really, what were the, what are the things that you remember most from childhood? Where did you grow up?
Okay. Well, I was born in Seattle, Washington, actually on the West Coast, but didn't live there very long. My father's family was there, but then job took him to the Midwest. And I lived for a few years in Wisconsin, but I don't remember that very well either, because then we relocated again to the East Coast. So basically, I grew up in Connecticut, in a suburb of New York, and my father initially, you know, commuted to the city. So this is the, you know, the 1960s. Which was very much a thing that a lot of people living in the suburbs, commuting to the cities. And growing up there, I wanted to be a scientist as a kid. I was, you know, bookish and read a lot. And this was also the era of the Apollo program. I was just 10 when men walked on the moon. So every kid wanted to be an astronaut. And I was going to be an astrophysicist, I decided. And, you know, read a lot about that and did, you know, take science and math and headed to college, and then found that I was, you know, overwhelmed by the math, which I wasn't that good at after all. And suddenly it wasn't that much fun anymore. And I think maybe I liked science fiction better than science, might have been the truth of it. So at that point, though, I also got interested in philosophy. And, you know, I'd been raised in as a Lutheran, which I still am. So I'd say, a mainline Christian denomination. And, you know, so not exactly liberal, but hardly fundamentalist at all. But, you know, the mainline Christianity, which is continuing to decrease in the United States, actually, but at that point was still kind of a thing, very much alive. And so I was able to integrate science and religion together. But I went to college and I met a lot of fundamentalists who not only were suspicious of things like evolution, which I had no problem with, but also seemed to have a kind of narrowness about them and kind of judgmentalism and that I found disturbing. And I began to wonder, is this what my Christianity is about too? You know, maybe I need to examine my faith and think about how can I make this, you know, make sense for me in a way that's intellectually credible and morally credible? Because I didn't want to be judgmental towards other religions, et cetera. So I got interested in interfaith dialogue and philosophy of religion and et cetera. Went on, got degrees in theology, really as a result of my own religious questions. So I think that's what really led me to wanting to be a teacher of religion, to then help young people also figure out a lot of these questions they might have as they're examining their own faith, becoming young adults.
And were these the things that interested you in terms of faith, in terms of, well, even film? I mean, in terms of childhood, for example, can you sort of look back and see a pattern in terms of how your life, the film stuff obviously academically was later, but can you sort of look back and say, yes, the interest all started at the age of 5 or 6?
Well, I do have to say, and again, I didn't regard film as a serious academic pursuit until I started, you know, writing, you know, publishing in this really in mid-career practically, but I have always, always loved movies. You know, you say how you were, you know, more of a radio person to begin with, but if I think of my earliest memories, you know, and I have heard some of your interviews where you ask people what their earliest memories are, that's kind of interesting that, and this is, you know, I didn't think of this actually having to do with movies until I focused on it, but my very earliest memories are two. One is, the first film I saw in a theater was The Music Man. So when that came out, I was 3 years old. And I believe this is a genuine memory that I remember seeing that. And it was a color movie. And of course, we had a black and white television, so I'd never seen a color before. And it was huge and colorful and exciting. And it's a movie that is set in Iowa, as it happens, although I didn't become an Iowa resident till several decades later. But I've always loved that musical too, but you know, at 3 years old, I got very into that and was running around singing the songs after that, apparently. So that was, you know, very, immersive experience of movies that I remember. The other experience from around the same time, and this would have been, we'd already moved away from Seattle, but the Seattle World's Fair was around that time too, I think in 1962. And we went back to visit family and visited the fair there. And there was some kind of movie experience, immersive movie experience about space. And again, remember, people were getting very entranced with this and space travel was starting. And we were in this big theater with this big screen showing space. And I was kind of bored, I think. And so I said rather loudly, when do we get out of here? And the audience laughed. So I still remember that because I remember, like, why are they laughing? What's wrong with this? As my father later explained, he said, I think they thought you were on a spaceship, and that's why you wanted to get out of there. But again, these two experiences when I was like 3 years old, both have to do with movies and being immersed in a movie, I think means something. And I always loved movies, watched a lot of movies on television, watched a lot of television shows growing up. I was very bad at sports, so I was, you know, would rather watch television, frankly. And just became sort of encyclopedic on the history of film, you know, by the time I was a teenager, just because I loved, you know, everything about old movies, you know, through the 30s and 40s, and I still carry a lot of that useless information around with me.
Did you ever used to write any of this down? Did you like keep a diary, for example, when you were young?
No, not really. No, I don't think like notes about shows I was watching or something like that. I guess I did take my hand at writing a little bit of science fiction, not very good, you know, as a kid. I've never done that very seriously, never written fiction seriously. But, you know, sort of storytelling and certainly enjoying a lot of the stories, you know, that were coming out with, especially science fiction. I was a big Star Trek fan because that came out when I was young. And so as I grew up, you know, I had friends who were into Star Trek. And then once Star Wars came out, of course, that was it. You know, that was true love. Although that didn't come out until I graduated from high school. But I had a group of friends. It was pretty nerdy, pretty geeky. And again, I was heading for the sciences. So we were all into the technical aspects. And so lots of fans of science fiction shows. And that was, you know, kind of a watershed also for science fiction film, that they started to get a lot better after that. Because there were a lot of these very cheesy sci-fi films from the 50s, which I still enjoy kind of, but things began to get a lot better, you know, after Star Wars. And so there was a group of us kind of that enjoyed this sort of thing very much so.
And certainly for me, music had the same kind of impact, in the sense that we used to, on a Monday morning in school, all talk about what we'd heard on the radio on the weekend in the charts and the sort of the top 40. And that actually, I would say that really did define that age. I mean, it's funny with my own children, I'm not really interested. I can't even remember. Or maybe even at the time, I wasn't even aware of what was in the charts at the time. But, you know, going back to the 80s particularly, it's almost like that the encyclopedia interest in film that you mentioned, I had with the pop charts. And did any of that resonate with you when you were growing up?
Well, it's interesting because I think I actually appreciate pop music from previous decades more now. You know, it was just sort of always on the radio, but I wasn't really thinking about it a lot. And now, you know, kind of enjoy going back and, you know, listening to 60s, 70s, 80s rock, for example. So I appreciate it more now. I think I was kind of a snob at the time, actually, because I come from a very musical family. And so there, you know, there are actual musicians in the family, some of them, you know, making a living through that. And so classical music was very much emphasized in my home, and traditional church music. Lutherans, you know, have always valued music, both choral and instrumental. And so, you know, we all played instruments, usually two instruments, and took lessons on them. So I played clarinet and saxophone and I love jazz. Once I discovered jazz, which I'm still a huge fan of. So I really like a broad range of music still. You know, I love and appreciate classical jazz as well as pop. I think I was kind of a snob though as a teenager, because I was spending more time learning my instrument and trying to become a fine musician. And actually, you considered maybe becoming a professional musician, although I didn't think I was good enough. And also jazz studies didn't seem like a thing at the time. It's actually become more since then. So there are actually professorships of jazz now, but I didn't know that at the time. And I was always determined to be an academic. I think I was, you know, 9 years old when I said, I'm gonna be a college professor. So that was the one thing I was certain about, because I was a precocious and annoying young child who liked to read books a lot. So maybe I thought I was gonna be a professor of physics, but you know, ended up a professor of religion. But along the way, you know, I might've been a professor of music if things had gone differently. But so that was, my experience is maybe a little bit different than someone who was totally immersed in pop music in that way.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because so many of the people I've interviewed will say that they really didn't imagine, or couldn't have imagined, that they'd end up even going in some cases to university, let alone staying there and becoming a lecturer or a professor. But so in that sense, it sounds like you've realized those childhood dreams. But what about your family? I mean, what did your parents do?
Well, my father was an accountant. Although initially, when he went to college, he was a music major, and he became a high school band teacher, actually, when he graduated college. And he might have done that for a number of years, actually. But he graduated college in 1941. And so he was, you know, happily teaching band in rural Minnesota. And of course, December 1941, the world changed. And so he joined the Navy. And he was a commander of a sub chaser in both oceans. He was present at the invasion of Normandy, and had a naval career throughout the war, but then, you know, mustered out in 46 and went back to school on the GI Bill to become an accountant. And that's what he did for his whole career. And my mother was a high school math teacher. She graduated from the same small college, Concordia College, Moorhead, which is up in the Fargo-Moorhead area of Minnesota, bordering on North Dakota. The college that's still there, Lutheran College. And they knew each other from when they were kids, though, separated by just a couple years. My mother was a couple years younger, but they didn't get married till the 50s. So it was years after the war, they got together and started their family that way. But so my father was someone who loved music, even though it was not his career, just loved music. So he had a lot of albums, a lot of old LPs of classical music. And also he loved musicals, grew up loving musicals. So that experience with the Music Man. And we'd go to, when we lived in the New York area, we would go into Broadway and see musicals there. So I have some, you know, fond memories of seeing some classic shows that way. And we owned the records and would sing along. And so that was something very much that was not his profession, but I think his avocation, what he, you know, he sang and played instruments his whole life, basically, as my mother did, who was quite a fine pianist and organist. She no longer worked outside the home after she got married, which was kind of traditional in those days. But, you know, they kept up kind of their interests in culture and the arts and music in a lot of ways. And of course, religion, you know, was a big part of our life as well as churchgoers.
Yeah, you must find that so many of, and it's obvious just listening to you, how a lot of that has rubbed off on you and the interest that you have and the musical influences, and obviously the religious background. It's something that has really carried through to this day. I mean, I find it with my own parents who, you know, sometimes it is very strange when you realize that you grew up in a particular era and yet the sounds of a previous era that you didn't live through, but which you are vicariously living through because it was your parents' era, is something that is quite all encompassing. And I always find it very interesting that I seem to be channeling something which I must have been exposed to when I was young, and maybe at the time resented it. I remember my dad once putting on, I think it was Slim Whitman, and I thought, oh, this is terrible music. I thought it's what old people listen to. And, you know, I'm perfectly happy with Slim Whitman, not just because Tim Burton used it in Mars Attacks, but it is strange sometimes and how things go full circle. My children are very young, and sometimes I think that the last thing they're ever going to be interested in is some of the music I like, because they always resist it in the way that I perhaps did when I was their age with my parents, who in turn used to say that the music I listened to was terrible compared to what they used to watch when they were young. And, you know, it all comes full circle.
Yeah, and you're talking about nostalgia in that sense, and I agree that I think I've inherited some of my parents' culture, and it's almost as if I lived through those decades, even though I did not. Yeah. You know, with my love of jazz, you know, I think sort of romantically of the era when jazz was popular, you know, and I love Benny Goodman as a jazz clarinetist. And I remember the first time I found a Benny Goodman record among my father's records, thought, this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard, you know, just because it wasn't something you were hearing on the radio at that time, but it was already historical music then. I did actually hear Benny Goodman a couple of times before he died, so that was nice. I heard him play, but you know, during his heyday, that was well before my time. And yet, you know, I've kind of got these romantic ideas about the jazz age. And you know, my parents were really products of the so-called greatest generation. You know, grew up during the Depression, and you know, they did not grow up in a privileged background. So you know, both my parents, you know, are college graduates, obviously. So I'm not the first generation to go to college, but you know, their parents, you know, were not highly educated, you know, living in farm communities and experiencing, you know, kind of the full brunt of the Great Depression and then the war. And so the fact that, you know, my father was in World War II and that my parents were adults and remember that, it just seems mythological to me, you know, that is actually part of my life. And so I know I didn't live through those things, but I feel like I have a nostalgia for it indirectly, you know, that I can still say, you know, my father was in Normandy. You know, there's not a whole lot of people who could say that anymore.
No, and sometimes it's something you find, sadly, it could be at funerals, for example, but certainly you realize that you know things, or you picked up on things, or you were privy to conversations when you were young, which you kind of feel that if the people telling you them, those relatives, those ancestors, didn't get to write it down themselves, then that you have a certain obligation to do something with that material, because as you say, it will be lost. And I I think actually in some ways doing the interviews here stems from some of that. When I was at the funeral of a colleague who had retired some years earlier, and I learned things about him at his funeral, which I didn't know about him when he was alive. And I thought, if I'd known that he was interested in X, Y, Z, I would have had those conversations rather than always complaining about work or whatever, you know, the sort of conversations mm-hmm. we tended to have. And I thought, well, I didn't know about that. And now it's too late. And I wonder if on some level, this need to have this oral history has come from that kind of background. And I think that's probably lots of motivations for me to do this. But isn't that interesting? So you probably feel in that sense that although you didn't experience it yourself, you were vicariously living something because you would have grown up in an environment whereby this was either talked about or certainly, or sometimes when something is not talked about, it can be just as powerful. But you can look back and you realize that there are some things that you're always very careful when you're young not to talk about, because you know that that could stir up all sorts of emotions on the part of the people who have a lot riding on them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, again, knowing my father was in World War II, but he didn't really want to talk about it. He didn't really want to talk about those experiences. I mean, about the one thing he mentioned about Normandy, because they were, you know, they were off in the water, you know, for support. But one of his main duties was picking up bodies afterwards. And there were a lot of bodies at Normandy. So he didn't really want to talk about that. But that, in a sense, made it even more powerful, as you say, that, you know, the things you don't talk about. And he, you know, got Alzheimer's fairly young, and so died in his 70s. So I lost him quite a while ago. He would be over 100 now if he was alive. My mother just died a year ago at the age of 97, and was quite with it. So we used to talk to her a lot, and I wish I had, you know, recorded her really with some of her stories, because, you know, I used to call, talking to her was like talking to a time traveler. Because, you know, she had all these memories from like the 1930s or 1920s even, and it was great. And so I really felt like it was a connection to something that was, you know, almost 100 years ago. And that is kind of precious. I agree that we need to save those memories. I think a lot of people feel that way with parents or grandparents. And it's a nice resource. I don't know if that has persisted as much in modern times, if we've lost some of those generational connections, although again, with technology, we should be able to preserve this better than ever. But it's a question also whether people are interested, and to what extent is your identity shaped by those prior identities. I think as I get older, I recognize the extent to which I am shaped by my family. And I always had very good family relationships, was very close to my family, and valued that. So I think it's shaped very much who I am and how I think about things, even though obviously there's been changes and adaptations and the world has changed tremendously. And I've become, you know, much more liberal about a lot of things. But my parents did too. I mean, they lived a long time. They were able to experience things and have broader views of things than they probably would have in their childhood. So in that way, you know, we all adapt and learn, but still draw on those traditions that shape us.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with my students a few years ago when they were saying, I think it was at the time in the UK when the David Cameron government was bringing in legislation on same-sex marriages. And the students were like, well, you know, our generation is fine with that. It's not an issue. Whereas when I was at university in the 90s, it was a huge issue, not over gay marriage. That was never on the agenda. It was just over whether it was okay to be in a relationship with somebody of the other sex, you know, and friends who were gay felt persecuted, and there was, and it just felt, and the politicians of the day didn't seem to be particularly sympathetic, and it's just seen that change in the course of 20 years, and I think it makes it easier for people today to do a bit of digging into the past, because social media certainly gives you that, you know, even on a superficial level, something like Facebook that gives you that whole, you know, this is what you were doing 5 years ago, or whatever it might be. But I think that sometimes the barriers have come down a little bit, that people feel that they can ask questions which you just wouldn't have thought was okay to ask 20 or 30 years ago. It just sometimes felt as though that there are some areas. I mean, women priests was an example. I remember talking to my the deacon, the female deacon at the church I used to go to, the Anglican church when I was growing up. And there was a project at school on should women be ordained? And I thought, I'll ask her, because she obviously has some thoughts about this. And, you know, it was quite clear she really didn't want to have that conversation. And I thought, gosh, I've stepped on. So I was only about 14. And I thought, well, I've obviously, you know, I thought she'd be excited to talk to me about it. And maybe it was because I realized now that I was asking her in the company of the vicar, the male priest. And it might be that that was a source of contention between them. And so in raising that, she didn't want to have that conversation with a 14-year-old in his presence. But as I say, you know, looking back, I see things a bit differently. And I find that more in, you know, rather than the abstract, do you believe in women priests? I'm interested in her, almost like ethnographically, I'm interested in that particular story. And I think that social media has allowed that, if you like, that turn to the self, that subjective turn to happen.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, in a way, we've come very far, and you can look back at a memory like that and wonder, like, why was this an issue? And yet I'm also struck by the ways in which we haven't come very far. And of course, you know, the United States is a really good example of this, where we have this incredibly divided culture. And, you know, we're seeing this, you know, right now with the, you know, recent, you know, defeat of Donald Trump's second term, but it continued to be people who were contesting the election results and people who don't believe in the virus and don't think they should wear masks. And this is absolutely bizarre. And again, people, you know, fighting against things like gay marriage and same-sex rights. And it's just, it's done. You know, it happened, people. You know, you do have to move forward. And it is interesting how some people get on board with that and some people really want to go backward and can really persist in these attitudes. And I guess it is because, you know, it is fairly recent still. But it's not all old people, of course, who are the most traditional. Sometimes it's younger people too, oddly. But, you know, these attitudes are recent and are raw. And there's a lot more evolution of society that has to happen. You know, with regards to gay rights, for example, you know, you bring that up from the 90s. 20 years ago, in the 90s, I was, you know, chair of a faculty senate at Dana College when an issue came up, not so much about, you know, outwardly gay faculty members, but about whether students would even be allowed to have a gay straight alliance on campus at a Christian college. And a major official in the admissions department was fighting against that and said, well, we're a Christian college. And, you know, I basically made an argument, a very Lutheran argument, I think, as head of faculty senate, which was later the same kind of argument used by my own denomination, the ELCA in America, to argue for allowing gay clergy, about the freedom of conscience, and which is a very Lutheran argument, obviously. You know, here I stand, I can do no other. We are entitled to some differences of opinion on some things that are contested areas, and we can't bind someone's right to express their identity. And this should be a no-brainer, but it was a case that had to be made even to allow students to have an openly gay identity. And the idea that that was even a question at the time, it even seemed a weird, it was a question to me that one would have to make that case, but you did. And now, you know, we've gotten past that in a lot of ways, and people aren't having to have those kind of arguments to allow their identity. And yet there are people, you know, pushing back against diversity in major ways, you know, and the success of Donald Trump's presidency is real evidence for that. And I think has been, you know, very alarming to many of us, especially in academia, you know, in that we want students to be open-minded and to think of things from different perspectives. Not that we just want to sell them liberal propaganda, but we want them to be able to think about things. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's so many people in our society who don't want to be open to those conversations, you know, seems to prevent them from moving forward. So however much we may be nostalgic about the past, there's a direction to history. You know, the universe bends toward justice, as Martin Luther King would say. We've somehow got to allow that to happen and in a way that still supports our own identities. But many people are very, very threatened by that, very threatened by those kind of changes.
And I think you're right. There's a big difference, a binary, if you like, between the university sector, which tends to be very liberal in its thinking, very progressive, and what happens outside. And it really struck just a few months in Britain before Trump was elected when we had Brexit. And I didn't know a single person. I'm sure, I mean, there must be people I know who voted for Brexit, but everybody that I spoke to, and often we just, this was an implicit thinking anyway, was in favor of staying in the EU. And when the result went the other way, it suddenly felt that whereas once upon a time, maybe we'd be in our ivory towers or otherwise, and people might sort of look to the university for direction and the steer, and we'd, you know, we'd be the, it'd be, where all the clever people would do all the thinking and would you know, be, have all these years worth of experience and wisdom that they could impart. then you suddenly felt we were out of step, and we were out of step with the times. And as I say, I did not see that coming. And then Trump's election, I did not, you know, imagine that that really realistically was a possibility. And again, it makes you think that all the different directions of travel and all the great strides that you make in a professional capacity really don't necessarily resonate in the same way outside. I mean, I've interviewed more than 90 people now for my podcast, and very well, of those, I would say the overwhelming majority, maybe almost exclusively, I would imagine, which says something about the people I know and the people I've interviewed, would be in the same kind of place on the spectrum that I am. And, you know, I haven't had a single person in the interview who suddenly said, yes, I'm all for Brexit or I'm all for Trump. And I find that interesting. And maybe in that sense, it's you know, in terms of diversity, I ought to be interviewing such people, but they're really not on my radar. And that is something that intrigues me as well, because this disconnect, which I hate in academic terms of, you know, the religious and the secular, we have those discussions academically, but I suddenly realize there's this even bigger binary which is playing out in the world around me, and I just didn't see it until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I think the places I have taught, certainly being in Nebraska and Iowa and the American Midwest, I've been very aware of how conservative students can be, and coming from very conservative backgrounds. So, we've had frank discussions all along about issues, and have had open conversations. But in general, when you have those, you allow people to have their views, whatever they are, and there's a range of views. Having the conversation in the end usually results in more openness. And, it is true that if only people with a college degree voted in the U.S. election, Donald Trump would have never been elected. And that's sort of a terrible thing to say. It sounds like this elitist thing that only people with college degrees should vote. I wouldn't say that. I would say that it shows the benefit of having a college or university education, that you think about things in a different way. You're more of a critical thinker. You're able to evaluate things. Even the fact that people believe all these conspiracy theories now about the election, it seems like they don't have the ability to sort out evidence in a normal sense and make sense of it. They listen to these strange websites and get their information there, and that's all that they believe, and they somehow think that's okay. So they don't have the ability to critically think through and examine information the way we prize ourselves on doing in the academy. So if somebody goes to college and studies anything practically, they will probably be more open-minded than they would be otherwise. And you hope you get closer to truth in that way. Maybe at least wear a mask during a pandemic or something like that. That might be helpful.
You absolutely. And it's funny what you said there about if everyone with a college degree voted, then it'd be pretty obvious who would have been elected. Somebody who was a student here at Kent, who's back in the States now, sent me an article to explain why Elizabeth Warren didn't get the nomination, because I thought she would have been a very effective candidate. And this article really explained that people who are educated, university people, see somebody like Elizabeth Warren, think she is perfect, she could be a great president. But it's like, well, but it's what about the people who don't have college degrees? They may not go for somebody like her. So all the sort of reasons I would gravitate towards someone like her and not, representative people outside. And again, that was a life lesson to me, because I'm seeing things through a very clear vantage point, and I'm not necessarily a representative person. I'm representative of an ivory tower type constituency.
Yeah, and it's easy to fall into that. And I think, still everybody's trying to figure out how is it that this kind of politics has been so popular, whether it's in the UK or the United States or wherever. There's been obviously an upswing in fascist rhetoric kind of worldwide, and fears of immigrants, et cetera, going on for some years, partly because of global demographics, et cetera. But, there may be something else going on that none of us have quite figured out. And it probably is hard for us to do that in the academy, although I would hope we are better positioned than most because we are critical thinkers, because we look at information. We should be able to figure this out too. And somehow one has to grant the humanity of those people, which is also hard to do in these very dichotomous situations where, they're so stupid, how could they possibly think that? And both sides are doing that to each other, and it proves very hard to move beyond that impasse. I think, the next administration in the U.S. is going to have that challenge, somehow getting past this, Biden wants everybody to work together. And he's already, keeping some Republicans in his leadership. But, we got to work together on this. So both sides need to be able to see that. But it's very hard when there's been a lot of name calling and some of it legitimate, when people have denied facts and have covered things up and, you can't get around that. So I'm not going to let you off the hook if you've done that. But, how do we move forward? How do we pull together as a community and try to solve problems? I think that's one of the great challenges of our world, essentially, and that universities can be a big part of this. And this may seem very far from talking about religion and film, but, strangely, I do see those things connected because, we're talking about our cultural values and how they're expressed through media. And when you begin to take a critical eye to that, look at the way movies portray Muslims or portray crime or portray violence or portray women, you're talking about all these issues that shape us and our values. And again, that gives you a critical eye to being able to move forward in the portrayal and the understanding of how we are a diverse world and how we are going to work together on social problems or whatever problems to solve them.
And indeed, that question comes up, doesn't it, about where we get our resources from? Because it's very easy. I mean, the Journal of Religion and Film in 97 was magnificent because suddenly it was this resource that gave us spontaneous information about films that had just been made. I remember reading about films like Contact just months after the film came out. Mm-hmm. Historically, you'd have to wait some years before a book might come out in a related subject area. So that's the plus side of it. But the negative side is, as you say, when sometimes people will go to sites that, I suppose it's the equivalent of a student going doing a Google search when you set them a question on whichever topic, and then they just use whatever sources come up on Google. Some of it may be academic, but very often not, and they just treat it in, as a source. And I think in that sense, it's being able to discern sources that is crucial rather than just looking at whatever happens to be available. But it's interesting that those challenges and those opportunities are often just two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I view that as one of my primary jobs as a teacher now, really, is helping students to understand information. And, library work has really changed from back in the day when you actually went to a physical library and looked up books and journals, and you looked in a little card catalog with the little paper cards and all. Maybe you're old enough to remember that. Yeah, that was definitely around for a while. Even when I became a professor, that was still the norm. And now with everything computerized, and it's great how much you can get online, that you can get journals, books, et cetera. The Journal of Religion and Film was one of the first all online journals. So we were ahead of the pack, but now, everything is sort of at your fingertips, which is great, especially during a pandemic. But teaching students how to discern the difference between sources. In my current Religion and Film class, this has been one of their assignments to do research on a film of their choice. And I'm vetting their sources. So, don't just, Google, a bunch of articles on it or something. And that may be useful for getting a popular perception of it. So I value that. I use that kind of research too. With your audience reception research, you have to know what fans are saying. And fan comments on IMDb may be really useful. And I've incorporated that a lot into my second edition of Film as Religion. But also you need the scholarly perspective to be able to step back and ask these kind of questions and think in a way that you maybe wouldn't otherwise. And luckily, you can find scholarly articles now on practically any film, even fairly recent ones, because publishing has exploded online, which is nice because it's cheaper, to produce things that way than it used to be when you had print journals. So it is very accessible if you can find it. There's great information out there on the internet. But as you say, you have to parse it. You have to figure out what's valuable and what's not. And if one is just a glutton consumer, that you're just taking it all in and or just picking, what agrees with you. I've had students say, I have a thesis. I have to look for the sources that agree with me. I said, no, look, you should just look for sources, look for good sources. Maybe the sources will disagree with you. Maybe your thesis will change as a result of your research. A scientist wouldn't think of just, okay, I'm going to prove this thing. I'm going to go find my evidence that supports this. No, you have to be open to the evidence and see if there's a supportable hypothesis. That's true in the humanities too. You have to look at evidence, but you can if you know how to look for it, if you know how to go through all that.
Yeah, my heart sank a few years ago when I was talking to a student who did a perfectly okay essay, but you could tell there was something missing, and I couldn't quite work out what it was. And I said, you're making a good argument, but it's kind of one-sided. And I said that in itself isn't the problem. It's just that you could have just given a bit of a counterpoint to the essay. And I know it was a short essay, I'll say. And what she said is, if she found a source that was opposite to what she was arguing, she was just freaked out by it and she ignored it. So she only looked at the things that she found aren't not so much what she thought, but that she thought were answering the question. So she thought the best way to answer this question is if ABC is right and XYZ is wrong. So she would get rid of XYZ. So it was a strange essay where she answered the question fine, but you could tell that there were some bits missing. And I, when she told me that, I did think, gosh, there needs to be a bit of a, we need to have a lesson on how to use sources and not, you know, and to use good sources rather than sources that just confirm whatever you think might be right. But how do you know what's right until you've done the investigation? It's a classic chicken and an egg scenario.
Oh, yeah. And you need to have opposing viewpoints. In fact, one thing I was very proud of at Dana College, I helped develop a curriculum there for our senior liberal arts seminar there, which was about issues, contemporary issues in society, where we used these volumes from Greenhaven Press that I think still exist called Opposing Viewpoints. And they were edited volumes put together where you went back and forth on an issue like abortion or the death penalty or gay rights. And we had very spirited discussions in class because they read these diverse views and then they had to respond to both sides in their essays, in the papers they wrote, and we had debates in class. And I think actually it's funny because this was the 90s and people were very willing to debate things. There's a lot of back and forth, even you know, in a fairly conservative state in the United States. In some ways, it's gotten harder to do that, maybe because it's so polarized politically now and people are sort of afraid to do that about certain things. It was nice that there was a certain openness that I think benefited everyone. And even if their view didn't change, they came to appreciate a different view. So I love those Opposing Viewpoints books. And I even did one on religion myself. Enduring Issues in Religion was the first book I edited 25 years ago now. I think the book is out of print. But I used it as a text in Intro to Religion for a while because it also offered this notion of diverse perspectives on a question. And you could compare religions that way. You could compare scholars of religion. And that's an important scholarly skill people need to have, is not just read one side of things, obviously. And people who don't like academia and think it's too liberal, they think it's these professors just propagandizing their students with one viewpoint. And generally, I think that is not the case for professors, not the people I know, who really do want students to be able to think things through. But that means challenging people to think in different ways than they have in the past. And that may be hard.
And I must ask you, because in a minute we'll look at some more philosophically based questions to round off, but I must ask about your Star Wars course, because you were in touch with me about that recently, and that just sounded awesome because you'll be doing that online.
Yeah, and again, this has been a learning curve, you know, during the pandemic, teaching differently. And I have to say, I've been pleasantly surprised with teaching fully asynchronous online courses, which the department here has done for years. And, you know, at my previous position, I even oversaw such courses and helped staff them and all without ever teaching them myself. So I knew enough about online education to oversee it, but I didn't really have a desire to do that because I thought, oh, I'm going to miss the classroom experience, et cetera. But teaching religion and film this term with a fully online class, and we've never met together physically or on Zoom, has been great because I've concocted all these discussion boards and, you know, encouraged people to have the kind of discussions that they can online, even asynchronously, and they've shared a lot, and it's really worked very well. So I'm going to do something similar with my Star Wars course next term. You know, and as you know, I have this long term relationship with Star Wars, you know, going back to, you know, when I saw the first film and always loved the films. Never thought this was a serious academic interest until I started to write papers on this and people liked them. And then just a couple of years ago, Ken Derry and I co-edited this book, The Myth Awakens, which was basically essays on The Force Awakens after the trilogy rebooted. And that was a great time to do that. So I'm going to use that text. I'm going to use some of the other essays that have come out from a variety of scholars. Look at audience reception, look at fandom, which is a huge experience, the whole fan reaction to Star Wars, the reaction against, you know, Disney, the Disneyfication of Star Wars, which is very controversial. So you can get into all these issues about commerce and big business and culture and the politics behind it. It's just sort of endless, the things you can do with it. I'm very much looking forward to that. And what I think I will have students do actually is, you know, their own research on a topic of their choice. They may choose to have a deep dive into something, you know, I don't even know that much about, some of the video games, some of the fan created objects, and kind of talk about the significance of that culturally. So it's kind of the anthropological approach again that I use in film as religion. You know, what are these films or what are these cultural products saying about us, about our society, and what does that reveal, and how, what kind of relationship should we have to that? Are they a mirror of our political or social values? Are they influencing us? And of course, I'm kind of planning on everybody in the class being fairly into Star Wars. If they're taking the class, they don't like Star Wars, they're going to have a rude awakening, but you know, because they've got to be into Star Wars. But it's amazing how much there is on this. And yeah, the fact that one can do an online course, also because the streaming content is just available, which is, I think, another good thing that has happened with technology. Sure, it's nice to be able to sit in a classroom and watch a movie together sometimes, but it takes up a lot of time. And one thing I found this semester, it's very easy to say to students, well, this is on Netflix, or this is something you can rent for $3 online. And of course, teaching a course on Star Wars, all I have to do is say, get a subscription to Disney Plus, and you're all set, because everything is there, including The Mandalorian, which is new. So yeah, in that way, I'm looking forward to that. That's the first time I have been able to teach an entire course on Star Wars. So I'm kind of amazed this is even happening, but my department said, would you like to teach a course on Star Wars? Well, twist my arm already. Okay, yeah, sure. And students are signing up as predicted, because it's something that interests them, you know? And again, you can talk about some very high concepts about culture and the influence of big business, et cetera. And at the same time about religion, and also do it in an entertaining way. So it can be a great learning experience, but also fun, which I think those things do go together, and students need to understand that as well.
Yeah, no, I always find myself saying to the students, I hope you enjoy writing the essay, or I hope you enjoy today's lecture. And I explain that actually that is exactly what I mean, because there shouldn't be this distinction. If you really have a passion for something, you'll enjoy it. And, you know, I'd rather have students there who are really on the edge of their seat, excited by what's being discussed, than just there for credit. So I think that your course sounds amazing. So, and you have to set the deadline for the day after the 3rd of May. You've obviously heard this joke before, but, you know, you need a May the 4th deadline for submissions.
I should probably do that. Yeah, I think that's around the end of the term anyway. So yeah, turn in your essays by May the 4th. Yeah,
because I think that's the date for our students' dissertation. So if someone does a dissertation on Star Wars, then I think then that's very apt. And they should just get a few bonus points, I think, just for thinking strategically and just being clever. Right. But a few more philosophically based questions to round off, John, because we've touched on nostalgia already in many forms. But would you say that your memories, as you look back on your life and career, are predominantly positive ones?
I would say so, yeah. And I think, you know, I have very happy family memories, and I recognize I'm privileged in that way, because not everyone has the perfect childhood. But as I said, I was very, very close to my parents and my sisters. And I've been fortunate in raising my children, being very close to them, both my wife and I. So we have, you know, a strong family, and I recognize that as something that is a gift not everyone has. And so lots of happy memories in that way personally. And I think also, you know, career-wise, obviously I've had some jumps and starts with, you know, Dana College going out of business, but I've been happy that I've always been fully employed as an academic, as a teacher, since the moment I finished my dissertation. And that's, you know, over 30 years now. So, and again, being in this position now is a great gift to be able to focus on religion and film. So overall, yeah, it's not like every moment of every year has been fun, obviously. And one can look back at times that were not so great and maybe be happy you're not in them anymore. You know, the current time in the pandemic obviously is very hard, you know, and I'm worried about the world. I'm worried about our country. And so that's a concern, but, you know, hopeful that we'll get through it, that things are looking a little bit better now, and that maybe a year from now, we'll all be heaving a sigh of relief in a lot of ways. But Yeah, I would say overall positive. And I know this is a question you ask people in these interviews, because I have listened to them. So I have two meta thoughts on that as well. One is that it's a funny question, isn't it? Because I think through most of human history, people didn't ask, you know, are you happy as the predominant question. It was, you know, have you obtained enlightenment or meaning or purpose? Or again, because I'm a Lutheran, you know, have you fulfilled your vocation? Have you done your duty? So I think when I look back at my life as I'm getting older now, I want to feel like I was, you know, the right kind of person who contributed in some way and made a difference. And, you know, personal happiness maybe shouldn't be the first thing I think about, but I also recognize we do that is you know, kind of a modern emphasis. And the other idea I have is that asking someone to kind of make a judgment on their whole life is an interesting thing, because there's, you know, there's illusion involved. And how does one choose to look at the whole thing? How do we know if it's predominantly happy or not? It's a picture preference, as Wittgenstein would say, and, you know, John Wisdom in his work on philosophy of religion, if you know it, uses that to apply to religion. How, you know, the two explorers who happen upon the garden, or the flowers in the wilderness. Well, is there a gardener or is there not a gardener? And he says, this is like, you know, trying to decide whether there's a God. You look at the universe. Oh, it's so beautiful and perfect. Someone must have designed it. No, it's just a bunch of random flowers growing. It's just some weeds. So no one can determine factually which is the correct answer, but we have sort of a picture maybe about our lives as well. So, you know, is my life overall, you know, good or not good? I don't know, but you know, the picture I'm choosing, yeah, is probably a positive one. I think there's a benefit to choosing a positive image of something. You know, speaking of movies also, there's this line from Endgame, you know, the end of the Avengers series, which we quote a lot in my family. I don't want to give away any spoilers here if somebody hasn't seen it, but there's a line that Tony Stark, AKA Iron Man, says, where he says, everything's going to work out the way it's supposed to. And that line proves especially poignant as the film develops. But we always say that because it's a little bit different from saying everything happens for a reason, which I don't believe, actually. But instead, if you say everything's going to work out the way it's supposed to, it gives you kind of an upbeat way of thinking about the whole. Even if you can't see exactly the purpose of something, that maybe overall, this is leading to the way it is supposed to be. So that's kind of a reassuring thought, too. And it's probably a picture preference, to which I owe Tony Stark for that one. So.
No, absolutely, because it's an interesting one, because I always follow that question up with the question about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I think it's interesting, because what am I trying to get at in asking the questions? And I think it's my sense that on many levels, certainly, you know, a superficial example is, you know, you've got a dissertation coming up, or you've got an exam coming up, and of course it's very stressful, but you go through it, and then hopefully if everything works to plan, then you say, yeah, I'm glad I went through that. It's the call to adventure, very Star Wars-ish as well, in that sense. You have to go through that challenge. If life was just, as you say, picture perfect, then it would all be without the challenges that actually mold us into being. That's a lot of very theodicy based as well. But at the same time, I always think that the follow-up question is the interesting one, because it's what we do with those negative experiences. And there are lots of things we can do with them. And I always am delighted I've had as many guests as I have for the podcast, but I'm quite sure that there must be people who sometimes would struggle with that question, because sometimes I know, to, you know, personal experience, some people will put certain things into a box, and they will say, I'm not going to bring that out. And in that sense, it can be very tortuous to try and work through those kind of emotions. But I do think that sometimes when you've triumphed over something, and again, this is, you know, very Star Wars based, then sometimes you say, well, actually, it was there for a reason. It was there for a purpose. And it might be a purpose that we are retrospectively putting onto that experience, and that is the bit that I'm interested in. It's how we do that. You know, politicians sometimes will. I think the mistake that Gordon Brown, when he was prime minister here, made was that he referred to himself as a conviction politician, and I thought, no, that's for others to say. You don't say that about yourself. I mean, Trump is very good at creating his own narrative, but I think that's for the history books. I think that's for your successors to make that kind of adjudication. But I guess on some level we are doing that, even if we're doing it, we might give different answers at different stages depending on our life journey.
I think of nostalgia as a positive experience usually, and I think that's maybe the dictionary definition of it, but I do recognize the point that one can remember something that was a hard time, a painful time, and that you learn something from it, which I think is the point you may be getting at there. That I do things that I don't want to go back to. I don't want to think about those times, but I know that they were beneficial. I know that, you know, I learned something out of that. And, you know, without challenges, without some difficult times, then we never appreciate anything. Then we never grow. And I do concur with that notion of John Hicks, for example, in terms of theodicy, that we have to go through these difficult experiences in order to learn from them. And if I think of a film example of that, the film Inside Out is a very good one, actually, the children's film. And actually, there's an essay in the Journal of Religion and Film associating that with the point of view of theodicy, that, you know, we learn from difficult things, we grow as a result. And in that movie, as you may recall, sadness, it has a very important function as one of the feelings inside the young girl's head, that you can't just be joyful all the time. And it's sadness that is able to actually share compassion and help her learn and grow as a person. So I would say that's true. I don't know if I'm nostalgic about hard times, but I recognize their value as part of experience, even if I don't want to go back over those experiences. And I also don't think that rose-colored glasses are so beneficial, because if one only remembers the beneficial or the happy moments, you know, and that's one way you can go through these things. You have a hard time and then you think, oh, well, that was such a wonderful time we had together. Well, yeah, maybe 3 minutes out of that hour was good. The rest of it wasn't very fun. But so you have to remember the whole experience. But at the same time, I think it's the fact that you get to a more positive place that is what I choose to focus on, or what I'd like to focus on.
Yeah, and that's really well put, because I was talking to a colleague here at work a few weeks ago, and I said, oh, you know, I don't think people will be looking back on 2020 very nostalgically. And of course, you know, I shouldn't have asked that, because, you know, because in a way I'm the first person to say, of course you can. But he said, well, actually you can be nostalgic, because there are things that we've triumphed over, with things that we've proven to ourselves. It doesn't make it doesn't mean to say that we want it again if we could go back in time, but it's a case of dealing with what we've got in front of us. And in many cases, I think at the beginning, people were talking about how awful people's mental health will be, and it, you know, the it's going to be a very corrosive period. And that is undoubtedly true. But I think an example is it's the run up to Christmas here, and the number of people who put up their Christmas trees a lot earlier than they normally would. Myself included, if I'm honest. And I think that is a really interesting development, that people are saying, this is not the year we wanted, but we're going to put our signature on it. We're going to put our stamp on it. And in that sense, we will look back and think, gosh, we did it. We managed to overcome something that we were told was going to be really debilitating, and is debilitating, and people are still losing their lives, but we're not going to let it completely tell us what to do. We're not going to let the virus determine every facet of our lives.
Yeah, I think people are nostalgic about World War II in that way, you know, that having gone through it, and I, even though I didn't go through it, I still have kind of that view, as I've said, maybe I romanticize it a bit, but recognizing how hard it was, and at the time, how uncertain everything seemed, people were made stronger by it, and they did survive and show, you know, great courage and resourcefulness. And probably that's also part of the attraction of Star Wars, right? Is that things are always going badly in the Star Wars universe, and yet people are struggling and somehow overcoming that, dealing with it. But there's always a crisis going on. We don't have movies about the relative periods of peace during the Republic, you know, before things start to fall apart again. And that's what makes good storytelling. And maybe that's how we think about our lives too, is how did we deal with those challenges. So you may be right. Maybe we'll look back and hopefully see the good things about this time period. I think even now there's some things I appreciate as silver linings, like, you know, more time spent with family in some ways when you're sort of stuck together. We've had some of that, and I've seen more of some people than others. And even, you know, this sort of thing, there's people I've reconnected with on Zoom that I Zoom with my high school friends once a month, and we hadn't talked for decades. And this is a long time ago. I went to high school, you know, we're talking about. And yet they've reconnected, that people have reached out because they kind of want that sort of thing. They want that connection, probably because they're missing a lot of other connections. But, you know, there's some benefit in that. The fact that we've been able to do that is a positive thing.
Yeah. And I think that question about whether you've found that the dreams that you had when you were young have been fulfilled, it's something that we touched on earlier, but it sounds like you're in a very positive place. The journey may have been a bit bumpy or even circuitous along the way, but in terms of where you are now, it's actually been a really positive journey, a very positive trajectory.
Yeah, I really can't complain. I view myself as really very privileged in my life, having been lucky to be able to do what I want to do, and, you know, got a lot of enjoyment out of that. I've had, you know, wonderful experiences with students and with so many individuals, and things I could not have predicted, you know, so it doesn't go the direction maybe you think it's going to. And it, again, it's not like all of it is wonderful, but yeah, really, really feeling good about it. And recognizing that is a privileged position to be in, because not everyone has it so easy. I do think that also means when one recognizes that, you have some responsibility to utilize that position of privilege on behalf of those who don't have as many advantages and try to make a difference. So again, I come back to my Lutheran vocation notion, I guess, that, you know, one should not just rest on one's laurels and be happy. Well, I lucked out. I didn't die during the pandemic, but, you know, instead have compassion and sympathy for all the difficulties people are going through, even if I've been shielded from much of that personally. Actually, you know, I haven't lost my job, I haven't lost my health, but many people have. And so recognizing the importance of feeling that and helping in any way one can for all of us to pull together. And that, I guess that's the thing about World War II, right? Is everybody seemed like they were all pulling together. And I don't always have that feeling now. I've been very disappointed in my country now, obviously, for not pulling together better, and for being highly individualistic, which Americans are very good at. So maybe we'll learn that. Maybe that'll be a good thing that can come out of this. Let's hope so anyway. I think we may have to, because as Benjamin Franklin once said, unless we hang together, we shall all hang separately.
And indeed very apt, because my very last question, John, is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
I would say looking forward, yeah. And, you know, I have a lot of memories, and as I say, I've lived a while at this point, so I have those, and a lot of those are good memories. And so I do reflect a lot on the past, but I don't want to think of myself as a looking back person in terms of, well, those were the good old days. That instead, you know, I recognize what's having gone through some things, things having gotten better, achieved certain things, and being able to celebrate those things also. So, yeah, I guess they may get to be a point where it's hard to look forward when you don't have that much forward left. And maybe there's a positive way of looking back that's not simply, well, those were the good old days. And I think my mother got to that point because, you know, as she got older and older, she didn't have much that she was doing anymore. But, you know, she felt good about a lot of things that she had done in her life, which is a positive way to think about a long life in that way. But I think while I still can, I'd like to be a looking forward person and be hopeful that there are good things ahead for myself, the people I care about, and the world, hopefully. You know, if we could solve climate change while I'm still alive, that'd be nice. I'd feel good about that, that I wouldn't have to worry about my grandchildren. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
John, it has been such a pleasure to have you as my guest this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. It's really been a pleasure for me, too. I'm glad we've had the chance to do this.